After three Harvard scientists published a review of studies in the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine casting aspersions on saturated fat, we ate more sugar and got really fat. And so today we pause to ask, should we believe all they tell us to believe about what is good to eat?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1078th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Firenze who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Strube on the boards. Jason, hello there.
Pleasure to roll with.
Quick question for you, Jason.
Yes, sir.
Who do you believe tells us the truth about what is good to eat?
I think you got to go with your gut.
Got to go with your gut, huh?
That's it.
Well, I guess so. Folks, there are three macronutrients we all must eat: fats, proteins, and carbohydrates. If we can be convinced to eat less of one of the macronutrients, we will eat more of another. 50 years ago, the sugar industry paid three Harvard scientists $50,000 in today's dollars to play down the link between sugar and heart disease and to promote saturated fat as the culprit. Their research was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Last year, the New York Times revealed how Coca-Cola, the world's largest producer of sugary beverages, has provided millions of dollars in funding to researchers to play down the link between sugary drinks and obesity. And this year, the Associated Press reported the candy makers are funding scientific studies that claim children who eat candy tend to weigh less than children who do not eat candy. Well, internal sugar industry documents discovered by UCSF professor of medicine Stanton Glantz and postdoctoral fellow Kristen Kearns suggest that five decades of dietary warfare between simple carbohydrates and saturated fats have been dominated by sugar industry money. Consequent to the 50 years of dietary warfare, generations of consumers have avoided eating foods containing saturated fats in favor of foods containing simple carbohydrates, with the results being obvious for all to see. That industry-funded research could be used to shape the nation's diet leads us to ask, should we believe all they tell us to believe about what is good to eat? And here to help us ponder the question, we have Dr. Stanton Glantz, professor of medicine, UCSF. Doctor, welcome aboard.
Well, thanks for having me.
So did I pretty much get it right on there, or did I err in some of my introduction there?
Oh, a slight error, and that is our study was limited to looking at the one Harvard study that you talked about. We didn't really look at sugar industry funding of research over five decades.
Okay.
Although they've been at, I mean, I can tell you, they've been at it for a long time, and the sugar industry understood very, very early that research linking sugar with disease could potentially threaten their markets, which is one of the reasons that they came up with the idea of hiring Harvard to write a review paper minimizing the risks of sugar.
Let's go back to you from your professor of medicine, UCSF.
Yes.
You teach students about medicine then.
Yeah, well, I mostly teach them about statistics.
Ah. And with respect to that, you're also director of Center for Tobacco Control Research and Education.
Yes.
So how did a tobacco guy get involved with sugar?
Way back in 1994, I got a box of previously secret tobacco industry documents that demonstrated that the tobacco companies knew that smoking was addictive and caused all kinds of diseases way back in the 1960s. And that collection has now grown to 90 million pages, and we've done a huge amount of research using industry documents to understand how the tobacco companies have manipulated science and public opinion and politics and a lot of other things. Kristen Kearns, who you mentioned, is a dentist who had found these sugar documents in various open archives around the country and contacted me and said, well, I'd like to learn more about how you do documents research. And I was very impressed at how smart and creative she was, and we managed to scrape together the money to bring her here as a postdoctoral fellow. Mm-hmm. She's finishing that up now and actually out looking for a real job as a professor.
Good for her. Well, yes. You brought up one of the dominant themes of today's shows, which is money. Well, so we ask, where do you scrape up money for this kind of research? Because it seems like you're not going to be able to get it from Coca-Cola or the tobacco industry.
Well, the work that we've done has been funded. This particular project we scraped together from several sources. One is I have grants from the National Cancer Institute that were broad enough that we could include the sugar work. The Institute for Health Policy Studies here at UCSF thought this was very important and innovative work, and they used some of their discretionary funds. I had a little bit of donor money that, and I kicked in, and as did the dental school. So we had to kind of piece it together.
So you didn't now, get any. It doesn't sound like you made any money from the industry then, or any industry.
No.
Okay, so get the money from where you can, but it's not going to come from those industries you're...
I don't think they're too interested in supporting this kind of work.
Okay. Well, fair enough. From tobacco to sugar and back to tobacco again. So I guess the obvious question is, do you see any similarities in the way the two industries work to shape public opinion?
Yes, it's quite amazing how similar they are. And I used to think that the tobacco companies were really ahead of the curve in understanding how important science was to public understanding of the risks of smoking and how actively they intervened to try to manipulate the scientific discussion. And we now know that a lot of other industries do that. I mean, the energy industry tries to do it on global warming. The cell phone industry tries to do it on cell phones. Pharma, although it's a bit different, engages in similar shenanigans. But I thought that they... You know, and sugar, too, because I had read the same stories in the newspaper that you talked about earlier.
Sure.
But the thing that that this work has shown us is that sugar was right in there with the tobacco companies way back in the beginning. They understood way back in the 60s.
Actually, even in the 50s, as I've read.
Back into the 40s. They understood that scientific evidence linking sugar with a disease or other health problems was posed a real threat to them. And so they were actively monitoring and intervening in the scientific discussion to try to steer things away from work that were and findings that would be bothersome to them. And they particularly looked at the emerging link between high sugar consumption, elevated triglyceride levels, and heart disease as both a huge problem but also an opportunity, because they saw if sugar got fingered as one of the causes of heart disease, they thought that would very severely affect their sales. But at the same time, if they could shift the entire burden onto fat, because at the time there was a growing appreciation for the fact that diet affected heart disease risk, and the two main dietary constituents that people were looking at were sugars and fats. And if they could shift the whole blame onto fat, and fat, you know, you should not eat a high-fat diet. That's bad for your heart, too. But if they could shift the entire blame onto fat, then that would expand their market. And because companies would start putting sugar in foods to replace the lost fat. So, and that's exactly what happened. So they won really big on this one. And, you know, they succeeded in really derailing the whole scientific debate over sugar and triglycerides for decades. Now, today, that people are beginning to understand that, appreciate.
But before we go on, Doctor, we're going to have to take a quick break, but what I would like to go back and what you were saying, there's a very simple mathematical formula here. We need carbohydrates, we need protein, and we need fats. So you set the protein aside and you look at carbohydrates and fats. If we can be convinced into eating less of one, we'll probably quite naturally be hungry enough to eat more of the other, right?
Well, I'm not a nutritionist, but, you know, basically, I think it was more sophisticated than that.
Well, probably was. We'll pick it up when we get back from this break, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here, your host, with Dr. Stanton Glantz, UC SF Med School, Fats and Sugars.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land. We can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5-, 6-, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
Well, folks, 50 years ago, Harvard researchers published a study in the New England Journal of Medicine casting aspersions on saturated fats and holding up sugar, simple sugars as the way to eat instead of those nasty saturated fats. Recently, UCSF Professor of Medicine Stanton Glantz and Kristen Kearns, his assistant, opened up that box of musty old documents and discovered the fact that, wow, all of this study was funded by the sugar industry. And what does that mean? Kind of like opening up the Pandora's box on how money is used to convince us to eat things maybe we shouldn't be eating, like too much sugar. Dr. Glantz, thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Going back to that study, when did you really think that you had something in that box that was really worth taking out and putting on the table for us to consider?
I'm sorry, are you talking about the sugar documents or the tobacco documents?
Going back to the sugar documents.
Okay, well, again, it was really Kristen Kearns who found the documents. And
But she took them to you and said, Dr. Glantz, look at these. What do we do with them?
Yeah, well, I think it was just the things that she showed me, you know, showing that, in fact, the sugar, when the tobacco companies were setting up their program to try to manipulate science, which was called at the time the Tobacco Industry Research Committee. One of the people who applied for a job there was a guy named Robert Hockett, who had already been working for the sugar people. And he said, look what I've done for sugar. I can come do that for tobacco.
Uh-huh.
That was probably the most amazing single document, and it really showed that the sugar companies had a very, very sophisticated understanding of science and how to try to manipulate the science discussion.
You know, and when we talk about the sugar industry, we're not just talking about people who grow sugar cane or sugar beets. We're talking about all the people who take the processed sugar and put it into stuff and then sell the stuff to us. Most notably, of course, soft drink companies and whatnot. And
right. Now, the documents that Kristen has deals with the sugar, the companies that make the sugar.
Okay.
That they then sell to the soda companies. Now, they obviously, from a political point of view, work together. But at the in the time period we were looking at, which is 50 years ago, the documents that, that we were looking at deal with were from what was called the Sugar Association, which was the refiners.
Okay. And they, you know, back 50 years ago, of course, they being in the business of growing and processing and packaging and selling sugar, were probably always on the lookout for something that could have an impact on their industry. And one of the things that started to frighten them was the fact that medical research was starting to come out to point to the adverse impact of eating too much sugar and heart disease.
Yeah.
And so from that, they decided that, well, we have to do something. So what did they do?
Well, they were very closely monitoring the evolution of the scientific discussion of the health effects of sugar. And they then intervened by hiring Harvard to write a review that basically poo-pooed the evidence linking sugar and heart disease and pumped up the evidence linking fat with heart disease. Mm-hmm. And when you read the what the people at Harvard wrote was called a scientific review, which is a paper that sums up the other science. There was no new original research in there. But review papers are very important and influential because both the scientific community as well as policymakers go to them because they sort of sum up the current state of knowledge in one place. And in that review, they, if you read it really closely, which is what we did, it there's a real scientific double standard being applied to the sugar and evidence and the fat evidence. And for the sugar studies, the Harvard authors were hypercritical of every study and sort of went through them one at a time, trying to discredit them. And in fact, the Sugar Association had sent them a list of seven studies that they were particularly worried about, and the Harvard authors dutifully just trashed each one of the seven. When you look at the fat evidence, it was just the opposite. They accepted everything without much criticism. They stepped back and tried to look at the big picture, which is, I think, the important thing you should do in writing a review, and saying, okay, when you look at all these studies taken together, is there an overall pattern that emerges? And they said, yes, fat is bad. We need to do something about it. Whereas with the sugar, they didn't do that important critical step of saying, okay, no study is perfect. We can find something wrong with everything. But when you look at the evidence taken together as a whole, is there an overall pattern suggesting that increased sugar intake is associated with higher triglyceride levels, and which is then associated with higher heart disease risk? And I'm not an expert in triglycerides, but I've certainly reviewed a lot of scientific papers. I spent 10 years as the associate editor of a cardiology journal. And my reading of it is that, you know, while the case wasn't closed at that point for sugar, nor was it closed with fat either back then, the evidence was certainly at least as strong as the fat evidence. So that's what the sugar industry bought.
And one of the big fat studies of the times was that produced by Dr. Ansel Keys up in Minnesota. I think it was called the Seven Country Studies or something like that.
Yeah, I know Keys was working in the area, and I know about that study. I don't remember the details.
Okay, so at any rate, you know, what they did then is they took all of the studies and said, divided them in half, the sugar studies over here, the fat studies over here. Sugar studies are bad and don't mean anything, but those studies that point to bad fats, they're good. And so they put that in their paper in the New England Journal of Medicine. And so what happened with the medical community then in the nutrition community? They looked at this paper and said, wow, this is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Well, I think that, you know, I wasn't, you know, when all this happened in the mid-60s, I was just graduating from high school. I may have been in college by then. And, you know, the short answer to your question is, you know, I wasn't there. I didn't interview anybody. Most of the people involved are now dead. But I can just tell you from looking at how it evolved after that, the discussion of triglycerides and sugar faded out for a long time. And when you write review papers, and I've written several review papers myself, they're very influential because people say, okay, this, if they're written by a credible source, this is, you know, seems like a fair, they're applying their best judgment. This is a fair assessment of the evidence. And, you know, Harvard is Harvard, and people just looked at it. And I think you can see they did this, and, you know, it wasn't the only thing going on at the time. But then the triglyceride and sugar issue sort of faded away for a long time. Now, in the last 10 years or so, the issues come back, and there's now a pretty widely accepted, certainly not by the sugar industry, but by a lot of other scientists, connection between sugar and heart disease. You know, and when all this happened in the mid-60s, I was just graduating from high school. I may have been in college by then. And, you know, the short answer to your question is, you know, I wasn't there. I didn't interview anybody. But most of the people involved are now dead. But I can just tell you from looking at how the literature evolved after that, the discussion of triglycerides and sugar faded out for a long time. And when you write review papers, and I've written several review papers myself, if they're very influential because people say, okay, this, if they're written by a credible source, this is, you know, seems like a fair, they're applying their best judgment. This is a fair assessment of the evidence. And, you know, Harvard is Harvard, and people just looked at it. And I think you can see they did this, and, you know, it wasn't the only thing going on at the time. But then the triglyceride and sugar issue sort of faded away for a long time. Now, in the last 10 years or so, the issues come back, and there's now a pretty widely accepted, certainly not by the sugar industry, but by a lot of other scientists, connection between sugar and heart disease.
And sugar and diabetes.
The sugar industry, well, that wasn't what this paper was about.
Correct.
Yeah. There's a sugar diabetes connection too, but this paper was specifically looking at heart disease, and you know they managed to, through this and other actions that they most likely were doing, to kind of derail that whole discussion for a long, long time. And one of the things that you see with tobacco is that, you know, the tobacco companies know that they're losing. But they make so much money off of tobacco that if they can just slow down the process a little bit.
There you go. Make more money that way.
If you look here in the current election, we've got a tobacco tax.
I know. That's and a sugar tax. And that's where we'd like to go when we get back from this break. Folks, Food Chain Radio Program, Dr. Stanton Glantz, we're talking about the role money plays from industry in the decision about what we should and should not eat. Right back. Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're taking a 50-year-old study out of the box that it's been stored in for the last five decades and dusting it off and looking at how it was put together. We see it was put together with money donated by the sugar industry to prove that sugar is not so bad and fats are really bad. And now, 50 years later, everybody's looking at that study and say, boy, how did we come to believe that? But it's, of course, not just the sugar industry that employs its money. When you have a product like sugar or like tobacco, you can make a lot of money selling the stuff to the folks. And folks are willing to pay for that stuff. And we can use that money then to convince the world that it's okay to be eating that stuff. At least that seems to be the lesson we're learning today by looking at these studies in the past. Dr. Stanton Glantz, what happened when we took the sugar industry's advice 50 years ago and we stopped eating butter and we stopped eating whole milk and drinking whole milk and stop eating eggs and eating the fats. And we went to liquid fats, vegetable fats. What happened to our body politic then?
Well, people got fatter.
A lot of people got a lot fatter.
Yeah, I mean, and I mean, you can't. I don't think that you can attribute it just to like more sugar, although that's definitely an important element in it. But the technology that the big food companies use in designing the foods that they're selling got better and better and better from their point of view of profit maximization. So foods were designed to maximize consumption, so people just ate more. So I think that if the foods themselves became more what doctors call obesogenic, but also they were designed to increase consumption by having people not be satiated in eating them. I mean, it's very much the same kind of thing that the cigarette companies have done in designing cigarettes in a way to maximize consumption. By, you know, people look at a cigarette and think of it as just some tobacco rolled up in a piece of paper, and that's just not true. It's a highly engineered drug delivery device that delivers a meter dose of nicotine on each puff. They control the particle size. They control the acidity of the smoke. They use additives like menthol to anesthetize your throat so the smoke will get deeper into your lungs. And all of that is designed to maximize consumption. Well, the food industry has done the same kind of thing. And the mixtures of ingredients, the salt and the fat and the sugar mixes are all optimized in order to maximize consumption. And in fact, one of the things, I'm just sort of off the subject, but I'm going to be voting no on the marijuana legalization initiative, Prop 64, even though I don't think marijuana should be illegal. But I think Prop 64 is going to put in place the same kind of corporate profit maximizing industry that we have in big food and big tobacco, and that they're going to start doing product engineering and heavy marketing on marijuana products with tremendous negative impacts on health.
Well, they seem to get away with the negative impacts on health and whatnot because they know how to manufacture these products, but they also know how to spend their money.
Sure. Well, that's and again, if you look at the fight over the tobacco tax and the sugar tax that are going on right now, you see huge amounts of political money coming in trying to stop Prop 56, which is the tobacco tax, a very sensible tax that will reduce cigarette consumption and could actually help us, I think, wipe out tobacco as a public health problem in California. If it weren't for three giant multinational tobacco companies, mostly two, Philip Morris and Reynolds, there would be no campaign against 56. It would just sail through. Mm-hmm. The same thing's, I think, going on when you look at the two sugar taxes, the one here in San Francisco and the one in Oakland. The big sugar companies, the soda companies, are in here spending tens of millions of dollars trying to block a good public health policy, and that is if you raise the price of soda, you're going to consume less of the sugary sodas. And in Mexico, where they did this, they showed effects on diabetes rates the next year. So, you know, I think that these industries realize that their ability to be as profitable as possible is heavily dependent on avoiding sensible regulations, and that's what you're seeing playing out in the tobacco industry fighting 56 and the soda companies fighting the soda taxes here in San Francisco. And again, well, the thing that scares me the most about 64, the marijuana legalization initiative, is it's putting in place the regulatory framework where we're going to have exactly the same kind of big marijuana industry that we have with big tobacco and big food and big sugar.
So there it is. Well, it's not just money at the polls we see. It's also, you know, money being put in all kinds of different places. There's a study out of Boston U's med school. Between 2011 and 2015, Coke and Pepsi sponsored 96 national health organizations, including many med schools and research institutions. And they used that money to turn a lot of organizations against sugar taxes, including Save Our Children, which got $5 million from the sugar industry. The Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics got almost $1 million. The NAACP and the Hispanic Federations both got money to turn their back on sugar tax laws. That's a lot of money being put forth just to keep the ability to make a lot of money, I guess, right? Those companies are spending well and making money to and spending their money to be able to make money. So, can anything be done about it? There's one thing that I found interesting, and that's the difference between the conflict of interest rules and regulations that took place back in that original sugar study. It seemed like the sugar industry could go in and buy three Harvard scientists, and nobody said anything. Have those rules changed, Dr. Glantz? I don't know. Maybe we lost Dr. Glantz. I don't know. Dr. Glantz, are you there? Well, I guess Dr. Glantz is not there, but I guess it's time to take a quick break, and so we'll try to pick him up again. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour. Today we're looking at how industries that make a lot of money selling things that, well, maybe we shouldn't be eating a lot of, most notably added sugars and tobacco. I guess I'm a fan of Coca-Cola. Once or twice a year, I'll track down a Coca-Cola, and I always look for those Coca-Colas that are manufactured in Mexico because they still contain real sugar instead of the high fructose corn syrup. So I always find those. But those industries that make so much money selling these things are using their money to influence people who tell us what maybe we should be not eating these things and consuming so much of them. But they have so much money to spend, and they're so clever at how they spend it, we scratch our head and wonder, who should we listen to and about what is good and what is not good to eat? This is The Food Chain, right back with Dr. Glantz. Well, folks, as everybody knows, there's an election going on, and there is a lot of money being poured into the election campaigns for this candidate and that candidate. And, of course, big sugar in the form of Coca-Cola is putting in. We note that they have donated $10 million to the Clinton Foundation. But everybody seems to be buying influence in politics. They're buying influence in medical schools. They're buying influence with organizations that supposed to represent consumers. So, you know, we look at all this money being poured into convincing us to eat things perhaps we should not, and scratch our head and wonder, is there any chance of consumers winning out on this? Recent Scientific American article says if soda companies don't want to be treated like tobacco companies, they need to stop acting like them. Dr. Glantz, you kind of taken a really close look at both industries. A lot of similarities on how they at work to take some of their money to convince us that we should be consuming more of the things that they sell.
Right. I mean, I think you're seeing that playing out in the current election here in California, actually, in three initiatives. You see the tobacco companies, they put in over $70 million so far trying to block Proposition 56, the tobacco tax, which would increase the funding for the state's anti-smoking program and fund health care for poor people. If the big cigarette companies weren't there, there would be no opposition whatsoever to increasing the tobacco tax. If you look at the two sugar initiatives, that are before the voters here in San Francisco and Oakland, the soda industry, for the most part, has put tens of millions of dollars into blocking these two local actions that would, again, do a very sensible thing from a public health perspective, and that is increase the tax on sugar-sweetened beverages. And a similar tax has been shown to have a very positive health effect down in Mexico. And you're actually also seeing it in Prop 64, the marijuana initiative, which would really create a legal structure for a big corporatized marijuana industry here in California. And you see $20 million or so having come into that, mostly from venture capitalists. And money's always been an issue in politics, but what you're seeing here is a concentrated power of large corporate interests really fighting back against public health. Now, the good news, and at least in terms of Proposition 56, the tobacco tax, I don't know the details of the other two, is that despite $70 million or so spent against it so far, the public looks like they're going to pass the tobacco tax, which is a good thing. Mm-hmm. The problem when you look at the marijuana tax is that the yes side is so dominating the no side financially that there's really not a sensible public discussion.
Where's the money coming from? Where's the money coming for the yes on legalizing cannabis?
A lot of it is coming from venture capitalists.
Ah.
Sean Parker, the Facebook guy, or one of the early investors in Facebook, is putting a huge amount of money into it. And there, you know, that's an example. I mean, personally, I think marijuana should not be illegal. I think that the war on drugs has been a failure. But what we've been advocating is that it be legalized within a public health framework rather than a business framework.
Okay.
And it's very frustrating to me to watch because the fight has been very polarized between the people who just want to maintain a prohibitionist posture and the people who want to get rich. But mm-hmm. I think that I fully think if the marijuana legalization continues forward the way it's moving, that we're going to see a marijuana industry very much like the tobacco industry, very much like the junk food industry.
So there'll be industries that are pretty much dominated by very large entities that can that have the economies of scale to be able to buy regulations at government that restrict competition. And,
right.
And therefore, all of those little people who think they're going to be able to make money by growing a patch of pot in the backyard are going to be regulated out of existence. And
I don't know that will happen. The 64 actually allows you to grow marijuana in your backyard, but my wife has a vegetable garden. She grows lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
Eat lettuce that she grows, because we live in San Francisco. There's not a whole lot you can grow,
but you can grow lettuce.
But it's very nice. But I mean, her growing lettuce in the backyard is not putting agribusiness out of business.
Right.
And I think when you look at the legal, people could make their own sodas for that matter. You can take carbonated water and sugar and flavors and make your own sodas if you want to. And I mean, a few people do. But the real problem we have with, in fact, if you look at sugar, the big problem we have is the way that sugar has been infused into the entire American diet
and
manufactured foods. If the amount of sugar people were eating was the amount of sugar they were just putting in foods they were, making from scratch themselves, I doubt that we would have a problem with sugar today. And the same thing, if you go back into the 19th century before the advent of the modern
tobacco. There was cannabis infused in everything. Folks, we're going to have to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to ask Dr. Glantz the big question, which is, how can we consumers arm ourselves with enough knowledge to be able to make decisions on our own about what is good to eat and what is not good to eat? Right back. Well, before we took a break, Dr. Glantz was talking a little bit about the parallels between tobacco, sugar, and the emerging cannabis industry, and talking about before cannabis was made illegal back in like 1937, they were very clever at putting in a lot of different things. Was that where you were going, Dr. Glantz?
Well, I think actually, no, I was talking about the future, not the past.
Okay.
And that is, you know, right now, in the last 20 years, the people growing marijuana have, you know, managed to breed plants that are higher in THC, excuse me, than, you know, they used to be. But we haven't seen anything like the kind of modern product engineering that you see in cigarettes or junk food, and that are where the product is carefully designed to maximize consumption. And, you know, I think the big problem that I see with Proposition 64 is it's setting up an environment which is going to make that happen. And so I think we're going to see big increases in use. I think probably the toxicity of the products will increase, because just as, you know, as junk food has become more and more sophisticated in its design in order to maximize profits.
Its design and its presentation and its marketing and its position in the mind of the marketplace. I guess the big question is, does money always win?
No, money doesn't always win. I mean, in the tobacco tax, Prop 56, at least so far, the money is losing. And the public health forces and medical forces, while they haven't raised nearly as much money as the tobacco companies have, I think the idea is good, and I think they're holding their own. I think if you go way back to 1988, the voters of California resisted a similar campaign by Big Tobacco and passed Proposition 99, which set up the state tobacco control program, which has been a gigantic success. Mm-hmm. We've cut smoking by more than half, and we've saved probably $200 billion in medical costs as a result. So you can't beat back these big corporate interests. I mean, the soda tax passed in Berkeley in the last election. It's just hard. And, you know, I think in terms of the topic of this show, I mean, the healthiest thing to do and the best thing to do politically is eat real food and just not buy stuff from these big corporations. Because when you talk to the people who are nutrition experts, and again, I'm a tobacco expert who has gotten engaged in the sugar issue, but all of my colleagues who are experts on nutrition say, if you just eat real food rather than buying these manufactured foods, you're going to be better off, because it's very hard to actually make real food that's as toxic as a can of Coca-Cola.
Yeah. I mean, they don't have the product engineering for that, do they?
Right, and you know, if you look at it, I mean, I don't remember the exact number, but a can of Coca-Cola has many teaspoons of sugar in it. And if you were making something, you know, if you made a cup of tea and put some sugar in it,
put eight teaspoons of sugar in it, it would be pretty ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Stanton, we're out of time, but I'm so sorry, because this subject is so incredibly interesting to see how industries that have great things to sell, like sugar and tobacco and like cannabis, oh my goodness, and how they can use that money to influence how we consume their products. Real dangerous stuff. But I think we should all bear in mind Michael Olson's third law of the food chain: cheap food isn't. And Dr. Stanton, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you all for tuning in. Sorry for all of those who tried to call but could not get in.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.